This is Focus 580, the second hour of the program. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the life and work of American painter Thomas Eakins. He is someone who is probably not well known generally here in the United States, and unless perhaps you've studied American art history. But he is someone who has now come to be regarded, at least many would say, that he was the finest portrait painter that America has ever produced. However, in his time, Eakins had few admirers. He was a controversial figure. In Europe, they considered him parochial, and here in the United States, he was considered much too avant-garde. As an individual, apparently he was extremely difficult, or could be very difficult. And yet there was something, a lot of people would argue, there was something very, very compelling about his work. And certainly in the time after his death, and particularly recently, could be argued that he has now finally achieved the place in American art that perhaps he always should have had. In this part of our program, we'll be talking with Sidney Kirkpatrick. He is the author of a newly published biography of Eakins, and the book is titled The Revenge of Thomas Eakins. It is published by the Yale University Press, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL for Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-WILL or 9455. No matter where you are, if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number and we'll pay for the call. Mr. Kirkpatrick, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Excellent.
Glad to have you talking with us today.
Well, gosh, it's wonderful. Thank you.
Eakins, I think, as I said, in recent years particularly, I think he has become better known, generally better known, that is, outside of the artistic community, people who study art history and so forth. I think now more people are familiar with him, perhaps recognize the name and have seen some of the work. And certainly, as we will explain, various champions did come along to advance his work after he died. I'm just curious about how it is that that you yourself got interested in Eakins, and this is now the second new major biography to come out about this man here within the last couple of years. What drew your interest and made you want to take up a major project like this?
Well, two things. Certainly, from a personal perspective, there is a real personal connection here. I have a stepdaughter who's an artist in California, and she underwent open heart surgery a few years ago. And it was really fascinating to me to watch how her own art changed so dramatically, having undergone the surgery, having just studied, you know, she wanted to visualize what was happening with her heart, how the surgeon was working. And she started doing these medical illustrations, and it had a profound impact, almost a transformation in her own art. And I got to thinking about Thomas Eakins, who was this, you know, turn-of-the-century portrait artist. But Eakins had started out studying surgery. His you know, initial love was medicine. He went to medical school, and, you know, three-quarters of the way through medical school, while specializing in surgery, he began to appreciate art. And he brought that experience into his art in much the same sort of opposite way that my stepdaughter did. And it had, you know, it too had this really profound impact on his art, because his paintings are all technically brilliant. You know, from the point of view of someone who has truly studied anatomy, who has studied the human body, you know, the people who appear in these portraits are very, very real. Of course, you know, you could even take that on further, because some of his greatest portraits, the painting that many art historians consider the masterpiece of American art, is of a surgeon in the midst of conducting a very complicated surgery in Philadelphia. So that was a sort of personal reason. It gave me an insight into how he operated as an artist. Mm-hmm. Secondly, which is what has brought this resurgence in interest in Aikens, is the discovery of a huge treasure trove of papers, just huge. Let's step back a moment to just sort of look at Thomas Aikens. When Aikens died, it was in 1916, you know, his paintings couldn't be given away. America sort of had essentially turned its back on this man. He had a student, Charlie Bregler, just a fascinating character. He was absolutely devoted to Thomas Aikens, almost neurotically so. Aikens didn't give him much time, much attention, and this Bregler couldn't paint actually very well, but he was just a devoted student. And when the scandals came up, when Philadelphians turned their back on him, when Aikens got these terrible reviews, Bregler took it really personally. It pissed him off. And after Aikens died, he was even increasingly angered by the fact that no one was treating his diaries, his letters, with great care, the heirs. And shortly before Aikens' house was to be sold, or the new owners were to take possession of it, this Bregler broke into the Aikens' house. And this is a house that had been continuously occupied for some 60 years. He broke in, and he collected all of Aikens' letters, his diaries, sketches, hundreds and hundreds of photographs. And he put them all together in trunks and hat boxes, and they remained hidden, you know, for the next 60, 70 years. And it's only recently, that they were rediscovered, acquired by the Philadelphia Museum, and are open to scholars. So this treasure trove of documents provides a real glimpse, picture window into this artist's life and times, something that didn't exist before. And so scholars, art historians, writers, everyone is eagerly studying these papers.
Mm-hmm. You know, whenever we talk about a subject that it like this that is inherently visual, this is a difficult thing to do on the radio. Because we cannot show the pictures as we're talking about them, so we have to try to describe them a little bit if that's possible. I'm thinking about as a way of trying to get into this, to talk a little bit about the painting that you mentioned, the Gross Clinic, which is probably one of his best known paintings. And this, as you say, it's a situation I'm sure people have seen, at least they've seen in movies, from the time when, for medical education and demonstration principles, surgeons and doctors would perform operations in amphitheater-like classrooms, and medical students and other doctors would sit and would watch. And that is apparently what's going on here, although the background is very much in shadow. You can just see hints of the fact that there are other people watching. And in the foreground of the painting, the main subject of the painting is are some doctors grouped around the surgery that's proceeding, and a lot of the painting is dark, and it looks like there's a light coming in from the upper left of the painting, shining down on who is no doubt the man who is the main surgeon, who is standing, and some other physicians that are all sort of sitting, looking at the patient. And it's a very striking because of the way the light works in the painting. It's very striking because there's some blood. In fact, the physician who is standing has a scalpel in his right hand, and he's got blood all over his hand, which apparently was one thing that just horrified people at the time. There were so many things that you can talk about, what makes this painting so powerful, light and shadow, the way the subjects are grouped, the subject matter itself, the realism with which it's portrayed, the fact that there is blood. It's a very, very, very dramatic picture. And one at the time that I guess was when it was first exhibited was quite controversial.
Oh, it was shocking. And, you know, I think you really hit on the key word when you said movie, because, you know, I come from a generation where, you know, movies are the thing. And, you know, my children's generation responds to things visually in a way that, you know, previous generations, you know, read books. And Aikens's paintings just hit you like moments from a motion picture. Look in at a frozen moment in time, but you're given enough details that that the painting becomes a story, and it's really as if you're peeking into a movie theater, and not just you know the portrait of Dr. Gross who's conducting surgery. Which, by the way, is in a you know is a giant painting. I mean, we're talking 8 feet high. So it's a huge painting with 30 or 40 people in the painting itself. So you know it's a large tableau. But the a large number of Aikens's paintings pull you in like this motion picture, whether you're looking at a rower on a river or a physicist. He painted a lot of scientists. You know, science science and engineering is very, very important to him. But a physicist at work in his laboratory, a boxer down for the count, a young pianist playing the piano. You look at the young pianist, and you want to see what she's playing, and you can sort of just barely see, see the notes on the page, on the musical score, on the piano. You see a cat coming in the side of the room. These paintings kind of draw you in, and really capture your attention in a way that a few other painters have been able to achieve. But it was that subject matter that I think a great many, that turned off. So many of Aikens's own contemporaries to it. I mean, they didn't want to see blood on a scalpel. And in fact, the surgeon, Dr. Gross, who's pictured in this painting, was mortified when the painting was first put on exhibit. He didn't want to be portrayed, with the blood. But, Aikens was interested in that realism.
Mm-hmm. That was something that comes through in a lot of his pictures, particularly in his portraits. And I think it's interesting that at the time, portrait painters, particularly celebrated portrait painters, I think were expected to improve upon their subjects, to make them look better than they actually did. And that Aikens almost had the opposite kind of intention. It seems that sometimes he actually wanted to make people look worse than they really did, or perhaps what it was that he was going for, he wanted to make people look like they really looked.
Yeah. So many of his subjects, complained about the portraits that he made of them. And second generations let's say a mother had her portrait done, her children would invariably stick that portrait in a closet eventually because they didn't want to remember her mother necessarily, with wrinkles around her eyes, with a mole on her cheek. Aikens has the sort of dubious distinction of having more of his portraits destroyed than any great modern artist. The one story which just immediately comes to mind is a mother superior at a nunnery outside of Philadelphia who was intrigued with Aikens's work and had a portrait of herself commissioned, and she absolutely loved the portrait. I mean, it's a very large portrait. It's called Mother Patricia. But those around her, the other nuns, just didn't like it at all. They wanted to see, a warm halo around her head. They wanted to see, a sort of glamorized Mother Teresa. And, that's not what Aikens delivered. So very soon after Mother Patricia died, you know, the nuns destroyed the painting. And that was not uncommon for, you know, many of Aiken's portraits.
Hmm. We have a caller here, and I want to not to make that person wait any longer. I want to bring them into the conversation. Of course, anyone listening can come into the conversation. Our guest this morning is Sidney Kirkpatrick, and he is the author of a new biography of Thomas Aikens, or Eakins, maybe. That's kind of the way that I've always heard it. E-A-K-I-N-S is the way the name is spelled, The Revenge of Thomas Aikens, and it's published by the Yale University Press. It is in bookstores now and features on the cover a very striking reproduction of a self-portrait that the artist did of himself. And questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone to talk with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I look forward to reading your book. I think the portrait of Aiken's wife in her late years is undoubtedly one of the most beautiful portraits in all of art, including the one that is so well-liked of Durer's mother in her older years. Could you tell us a little bit about his wife? There's something about a face that, the way he portrayed her, that she really had a difficult life, but somehow had strength and courage to overcome it.
Exactly. You know, you've really captured that painting. I'm so pleased that you mentioned that. One of the things you might do is compare earlier portraits of her to later ones,
mm-hmm.
to see the change, the sadness that Aikens injects into her face. What a difficult life. Aikens was, earlier in his life engaged to a woman named Catherine Crowell, who was a childhood friend, who died in one of the many, there were so many diseases spreading through Philadelphia in those years.
Right.
So Susan came along later. He was an adult. He was in his late 30s. She was his student, and she was very open. Like several of the students in Aikens' life, she posed nude for him, which was, which was a scandal at the time. Unfortunately, she entered his life when these scandals were really reaching their forefront, and I think, she was herself a great artist, a wonderful painter, who truly appreciated her husband's art and supported him as few other people in his life ever did. His father supported him. One of his sisters intermittently supported him. But Susan was really that rock, and I don't think Aikens would have weathered some of these storms the way he did without her steadfast, rock-solid support. But it was wearing on her, and it really shows in these paintings, in the wrinkles in her eyes, and in the sadness.
Thank you so much.
Well, also we have her to thank for the Aikens we know today, because after he died, she collected all of those paintings. It was not all that difficult because there wasn't a huge market for Aikens' work, but she collected and she steadfastly kept after the museums and eventually made an arrangement with the Metropolitan Museum in New York to have some of the paintings displayed. And there was an exhibition, and that caught a new generation's interest.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. I'm certainly glad that the caller brought up this this picture, because it is reproduced in the book. It's very striking. And I think of the portraits that are reproduced as plates in the book, that one and then the self-portrait that he painted 3-4 years later, I think, that's also on the cover of the book, I think equally striking. And the thing that makes me think, and I don't know who it was who said that the eyes were the window to the soul, but these two pictures in particular, somehow my eye goes right to their eyes, and the painting just pulls you into this very direct sort of confrontation almost with the subject. And I'm not sure confrontation is the right word exactly, but there's something in both of these pictures that that causes you to reflect on what it was that these people, what those eyes have seen in the lives of those people, I guess. Maybe that's the thing. It seems like a lifetime is written on these people's face.
Very engaging. I guess engaging is the word that keeps coming to my mind. These paintings engage you in ways that other art doesn't. And in many respects, it was a calculated kind of way. If you look at this giant portrait of Dr. Gross conducting surgery, the light pulls your eyes to various points in the painting. And when you first look at it, your first instant, it's very difficult to figure out what's going on. I mean, what kind of operation is going on? You see, you know, part of a body. You're not sure what part of that body it is. And you see the focus of attention around the body, and you see a figure behind the surgeon, a woman cringing, or, you know, her hands up, clutched as if she's in just great turmoil. And the more you study the painting, you start begin to realize that this woman in the back is probably the patient's mother, and you know she's witnessing this. Just, you know, it pulls you in and makes you ask these questions, and you start wondering and looking at it. One of the, you know, fun parts of working on this biography was finding, you know, who the people were who, you know, appear in the paintings, and studying their lives and seeing you get a much greater understanding of each of the paintings.
It is there again that when you look at this painting, it gives you a great appreciation, I think, for his ability to deal with light and shadow. And as you say, it's lit very dramatically, almost theatrically, and that in the painting there are really three places that are lit that I think your eye wants to go to. One is the place that the body part that they're working on, which I think actually is a leg. The other is the face of Dr. Gross, even though it's his eyes are and a lot of his face are in shadow. And the third place your eye goes is to his hand that is holding the scalpel that has the blood on it. Those three areas of the painting are, and then there's a guy in the background who appears to be making notes or something like that.
Yeah, which is Akins himself.
Oh, that's the artist.
Yeah, you know, like the great, you know, Hitchcock movies.
He did put himself in a lot of his paintings, didn't he?
Right. Yeah, and yeah. It's fun looking for him. You know, the other famous painting where he's clearly in the painting himself is Rower is out on the Schuylkill River. The Schuylkill is the major river, you know, that runs through Philadelphia, where Akins grew up, and it's a portrait of Tommy's, you know, high school friend Max Schmidt rowing out on the river. But in the background, you see Akins himself in another boat looking on, and you know it's Akins because it's written right on the side of the boat.
It's reproduced sort of small here, and I'm thinking, gosh, how can you possibly tell who that's supposed to be because the figure would be so small? But his name is actually on the boat.
Right, and you know, just like the Gross portrait with the surgery, this first, you know, portrait of Max Schmidt, which was arguably Akins' first great masterpiece, you know, received terrible, you know, it was just critically demolished when it was first shown. One of the great things that were written about the painting at the time was men and their wondrously ugly muscles. And it's, again, it was that attention to detail in the muscle, you know, muscles of the rower itself. You know, people didn't want to look at that. They wanted a glamorous, you know, vision of a man out on a river.
Let's talk with another listener here in Urbana, line one this time. Hello.
Oh, hello. How are you? Listening to you and talk to David and other people talk to you about your book, I thought the New York Times Sunday Book Review's review of your book was a little unfair, but I'm sure you've read it, but yeah, I always thought Aikens, I mean, I have a long love affair with his work. I've always thought he was sort of like set aside, brought back to the forefront again, set aside again, and I'm glad you brought him back to the forefront with your biography. It's his work is just an extremely interesting field of painting. I mean, not just the subject, but the way in which people have looked at it over the years. It's sort of, I always sort of thought of him as sort of a dark version of Winslow Homer. And, you know, so he would like say, okay, Winslow, you know, you do all these really bucolic, you know, everybody's happy, and then, you know, shooting, occasionally you'll shoot a mallard duck or something. That's your, you know, morbidity. But I always thought Aikens was just so misread by so many people, including the reviewer of your book in the New York Times, because he didn't see what you saw. And I'm just really glad you've done this, and I'm really looking forward to reading this. But I've always thought that Aikens was really, really underappreciated as an American artist and as a really intelligent, and not just a technically good painter, a great painter, but also an drawing subjects in that were certainly, you know, the nude swim, the swimming holes and all the nude, you know, the sort of supposedly erotic, homoerotic stuff, and completely, I mean, it's just, it's really great art because it makes people think, and I'm really glad you've written this book. I really look forward to reading it. Thank you.
No, yeah,
thank
you. You know, my mother, when the review arrived on Sunday, was sitting at the kitchen table with scissors, cutting off the last paragraph of the review because she couldn't stand it, and she had a whole stack of New York Times, and it was there, cutting off the last paragraph, and the last paragraph was an attack on the title, The Revenge of Thomas Aikens. And I call it a revenge because the very city that, you know, turned its back on Tommy before he died now, you know, embraces the man. I don't know, do you know, well, you must know the movie Rocky,
mm-hmm.
Sylvester Stallone.
Mm-hmm.
That takes place in the very neighborhood, you know, that's Tommy Aikens' neighborhood. That's the Philadelphia. When you see Rocky Balboa, Sylvester Stallone, you know, running through the meatpacking district, that's where Aikens grew up and painted and lived his entire life. When you see Rocky running up those steps at the end of the movie, you know, with his arms raised up, that's where all of Aikens' paintings are. And, you know, today at the foot of those steps is an area called Aikens Oval. And sort of in my mind's eye, I always pictured the ghost of Thomas Aikens out there on Aikens Oval, you know, stopping traffic and throwing up his hand and saying, see, I told you so.
Yeah. The Aikens was clearly fascinated with the human body and believed that it was to paint it, you really had to understand it. You had to understand how it was made and how it functioned. And he also certainly clearly felt that for students to study the body and to paint from life, to paint nudes from life, was something that you just had to do. And certainly that would have been, at one point at least, considered to be an important part of an artist's education. What was one of the things that was controversial, of course, was that he had mixed students in his class. He had men and he had women, and he thought it was just as important for the women to draw and to paint naked men as it was for the men. That got him into some trouble. I think that the sort of the controversy and the conversation around him has to do with asking the question, was his fascination with the body and wanting to portray it an act of courage and honesty, or was there some prurient interest here involved?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and that's certainly what has perplexed, you know, art historians over the many years. I think with the discovery of, you know, this Pandora's box of papers that Charlie Bregler, you know, claimed for us, I think it's very clear that, you know, Aikens truly was a searcher for truth, and that he didn't have the skills or the desire, perhaps, to play the politics, you know, that might have gotten him out from under those scandals. Someone like Walt Whitman, you know, who was a friend of Aikens, was much more careful to play the politics and was much more astute at dealing with the problems that came up with his poetry than that Aikens was unable to do. In many respects, you could easily argue that Aiken's just invited these problems. When parents in the Victorian era put their children or sent their daughters, to art school, I think they viewed it as a kind of polishing, a finishing school, where their daughters would be able to make polite conversation and have pretty little pictures to show. Well, Aikens was not about that, and in his decade-long teaching career, he demanded that men and women study the naked body. He urged all of them to study dissection. They had it in the basement of the Pennsylvania Academy where he taught for so many years. They had a whole room where they would bring cadavers in. And this was not, the preoccupation of a finishing school. The parents got, understandably upset, and they were very upset, in 1886 when Aikens removed the loincloth of a male model in front of a female class. It's what got him fired. It's what set into motion so many of the scandals which were to come.
Another of his paintings that is the ones that are of well known is the painting Swimming, and this is outside at the side of a water some body of water. I don't know if it's a river or a lake or stream or whatever, and an outcropping, and there's a group of young men naked who are sort of posed various ways, standing on the rock. Somebody is diving off into swims. It looks like somebody is climbing out. And it's interesting that he apparently, as a way of thinking about how he would do this painting, actually had some of his male students go out to this very place. And here with the plate of the painting Swimming, there's a picture, a photograph that looks very similar of that same sort of place, that same outcropping, and some of his students who are there naked, who are sort of standing and posed in various kinds of ways. And this painting has raised in a lot of people's minds a lot of questions about, particularly about Aikens and his sexual interests. Now, it's always difficult to look at this because now we're looking at it now. We're looking at it through our eyes, through the time that we are. And it's sort of dangerous to look with our eyes and say, well, that must have been what people saw at the time or what he saw or what he was trying to do. And I guess, though, I'm interested in what your thoughts are, particularly on the homoerotic content of this image and whether that's something we read into it. Is it fair to take that and then try to draw some conclusions about Aikens himself and who he was?
Art critics, art historians, especially in the academic community, have focused on that painting in particular. And, much can be read into the painting. You have a stone outcropping, a pier. It's actually an area in Pennsylvania called Dove Lake. And it's of a rather pastoral scene of, nude men bathing. You have, Thomas Aikens again, appears in this painting. He is one of he's the oldest figure, the oldest male, and he's nude also, and he's swimming up towards the pier. I think in many gender studies, books have focused on that painting as saying, well, this is clear evidence of Aikens's homoeroticism. Some of these same critics have used the Gross portrait in the same way, because the patient's buttocks is facing towards the viewer. I personally don't see homoeroticism in it. I view it in much the same way as Walt Whitman, described the innocence of a swimming hole. Certainly, one can argue, homoeroticism in such a painting. But like in many of the photographs, there are some probably 400 or 500 nude photographs that Aikens took that are in existence that you can study. None of these are sexually provocative. None of the models are posed in any kind of lurid or provocative way. I think we have to go with Aikens's vision of what beauty was. I think you've got to look at it in that same kind of innocence, in the same way a doctor would work on a patient, would study a patient. The painting we're discussing is Swimming. It's in Texas now. It's at the Fort Worth Art Museum, and it's clearly one of Aikens's greatest paintings.
He did also paint pictures of women, and sometimes painted pictures of women unclothed. So it was not something that he seemed to have exclusively an interest in the male body.
Right, and if you look at his personal life, of course, none of the scandals involved young men. He's even though Aikens today has been accused of all kinds of things, from homosexuality, has been accused of bestiality, incest, bigamy. The scandals, primarily, involve women posing.
And what did that, though, have to do with the way people felt about him? The fact that he could be very difficult and perhaps personally unpleasant, and also this attitude that he had toward what it was he wanted to paint and how he wanted to paint it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what happened was Aikens became a kind of lightning rod for the conflicted values, for the troubles of the Victorian era. And I think troubled people were attracted to Aikens because he wouldn't put up, he wouldn't put up with what his critics were saying. He went and did what he believed was right, and stubbornly adhered to it. So I think he became a lightning rod, and I think that many art students who themselves were troubled, maybe sexually troubled, were attracted to Aikens and glommed onto him. Two of the I'd say most continuing scandals involved these students. One was a young woman named Lillian Hammett, and we know from these Bregler papers, from the recent discovery, that she was a very troubled woman before she studied under Aikens. The scandal that involved Aikens was that she was arrested wandering through the streets of Philadelphia in a bathing suit claiming to be Mrs. Aikens. She wasn't Mrs. Aikens. She, went to a mental institution, which is perhaps where she belonged, or she should have received treatment. But if you study the papers, the documents, that Bregler discovered, I think a real innocence. I think Aikens is clearly innocent of any wrongdoing, and if anything, he and his wife Susan bent over backwards to help this woman.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Sidney Kirkpatrick. He's the author of a newly published biography of the painter, American painter, Thomas Aikens. And the title of his book is The Revenge of Thomas Aikens. It's published by the Yale University Press. Aikens lived from 1844 to 1916, was not well regarded in his time, however, since, has come to be generally regarded as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, American portrait painters. Questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. How much money did Aikens ever make from selling his work?
Certainly not enough to support himself. Aikens was very fortunate in that he had a very devoted father, and his father figures so very prominently in his life. His father taught penmanship at a Quaker school in Philadelphia, and because of his own real estate investments, was relatively well off and supported Aikens throughout his career. Left him the house that Aikens lived in, And I think certainly was responsible for steering Aikens into art and sort of setting the foundation, you know, for his work.
We talked a little bit about the title and the idea being that here we have someone who, during his lifetime, his work, he was personally attacked and criticized. His work was attacked and criticized. And now, long after his death, has now come to be regarded, very highly regarded as an important American artist. Was he angry? Was he bitter about what people said about him and about his work?
Not at first. In his 30s, he was a bit baffled by the reception of his work because, you know, critics would say, well, they would compliment how technically brilliant his work was, but at the same time, they didn't like it. And he didn't, you know, I don't think he understood that. He had studied, you know, briefly in Paris and Spain and was following a very realist tradition. And, you know, in the same way that Velázquez, Ribera, you know, the great Spanish artists, and I think he saw himself as the natural continuation of this tradition of realism. And, you know, he did it well, and he knew he did it well. I think he believed that eventually the public would come to understand and accept his art. Coming from a scientific background, I think he also... how to describe this? Science was much more open than the arts were during the Victorian era. I mean, this was an age of great inventions. When painting the Gross Clinic was first shown, you know, Alexander Graham Bell was introducing, you know, telephones. We had wonderful. Scientific discoveries, and the science community, as you know, like the physicians, were open to new ideas. We're open to things in a way that our arts were not open, and it was a sad contradiction of the Victorian era. And Aikens, coming from the science end of things, was far more open to these, you know, to new trends and things than I think the artists or the people buying the art were. Later on in his career, that you know there were these rumors of a secret conspiracy to keep his art from being shown. Eventually, that did get to him. In the last years of his life, he and his wife essentially closed themselves into you know Aikens' father's house, where they lived out the rest of their lives. In virtual solitude, in virtual isolation.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone listening this morning in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I remember the first time I saw Aikens' work in, you know, in a book. I liked it, and like I liked other photographs of artist work. Then when I actually saw one, you know, it was sort of like, I guess the most contemporary way I could think about it is standing in front of one of Pollock's, you know, things, you know, just sort of be, you know, the whole universe is sort of changed in a sense when you're looking through it. I'd like to know if you could sort of spin out what it is now we like about him and what it was they didn't like about him and how those values have changed and if there was any reason... you know, for that change other than, you know, artists doing their changes and things developing that way. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, certainly the tastes have changed dramatically. Aikens' paintings look to us today as being extremely modern. And you have to sort of take if it wasn't for the subject matter, I mean, you look at the Gross portrait and you see that this is not a contemporary scene of surgery, and yet it's treated that way. It's a very modern-looking painting, and I think that's certainly what attracts today's audiences to these paintings. You know, I personally respond to them, as I was saying earlier, as if they were a motion picture. And, you know, movies and Thomas Aikens are a very, very interesting subject. Had things gone a little differently for Aikens, he might well have become a film director. coming from a science and engineering background, he built his own still photography cameras and his own motion picture photography cameras. At the height of the big scandals, he was on the verge of making the first motion pictures. So he was very cutting edge throughout all his life. Certainly, from what we know of the Victorian era with a Gilded Age cover up. They just weren't interested in that kind of realism. The artists who were selling glamorized, stylized, romanticized the art in a way Aikens was unwilling to do. Aikens saw true beauty in what was there. Whether it really was the wrinkles around a woman's eyes, a mole on her cheek. The muscles on a rower.
Now, I was interested to learn that apparently there was some association between Aikens and Edward Muybridge,
right?
The photographer who was really famous for using, and I guess what he did was essentially he lined up a number of cameras and photographed people, animals in motion as a way of trying to. He was really the first one to do stop motion photography, and maybe it's not surprising to learn that Aikens would have thought that was really interesting too, because of his interest in the realistic depiction of the human body.
Well, I think there's far more to the story than is generally understood. As Aikens was working with Muybridge at the University of Pennsylvania in their engineering department, developing these techniques. There was a one summer in particular where they were, working hand in hand, and they got into a technical disagreement, and Aikens started developing his own technology. They also had a great difference of opinion as to what should be photographed. Muybridge was photographing. Dancing women. It was a more entertainment directed kind of subject matter. Aikens, was very interested, in musculature and skeletal structure. He photographed a man jumping, which is an image we have in this book. It was just a great tragedy that. The models that appeared in these early stop motion photographs were students, because this was brought up, this was raised, this was discussed. Horrible. You don't have your nude students appear in this, and unfortunately that stopped Aikens from continuing on. But had he continued on, he certainly would today be credited with the first motion picture photographs.
Hmm. How do you think he, or how did he, do you think, influence painters that came after?
Well, I think it took 30 or 40 years after he died before painters began to take notice. And once they took notice, an entire generation of realist painters, followed his technique. In some respects, I think it's fair to say he was born, at the wrong time. Had he been born 30 years later, I think he would have been immensely popular. Had he been born in Paris, I think he would have been immensely popular. But the fact that he was born in Philadelphia, and painted in the late 1800s, was a major strike against him. Many of his students, the great painter Mary Cassatt, they abandoned the United States, became expatriates, went to France and painted. Aikens truly loved Philadelphia. He loved America. He loved American sports. He loved our landscape. He loved science. And he really embraced these things, and they appear in his paintings. You couldn't pull Aikens out of Philadelphia.
Hmm.
There's just some wonderful letters you read where... someone saying, Tommy, don't you want to get out of here? And just get out of here? Are you kidding? This is, what a wonderful country we have. What a wonderful place this Philadelphia is. And, you know, if he wasn't so rooted in this, you know, in that city, I think he would have been much happier and certainly better appreciated. One of the things that I've done, I think, successfully in this book, there's a map in the end papers. You open the book and there's a map that I've taken, which identifies all the places, or many of the places, you know, where Aikens painted various portraits and where he was at various points in his career. You really can't do that kind of a map for many people because they aren't so rooted in a particular area. You know, virtually everything in all the important events in Aikens' life all took place within like a 10 or 15 block radius. You know, I urge all of you, anyone who's listening, if you ever go to Philadelphia, you know, go check out a map, you know, from my book and walk this area because so many of the locations are still there and you get a great insights into the paintings and, you know, have a good afternoon on top of it.
Yeah, well, we'll have to stop. It's a fascinating subject, and I encourage people to look at the book and then maybe go out, seek out some images and take a look at some of his paintings. You can certainly do that on the Internet. There are a lot of places that you can see them or get yourself down to the library.
In Illinois, too.
Well, and at that, I want to say, Mr. Kirkpatrick, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thanks so much, David. I appreciate it.
Our guest, Sidney Kirkpatrick, his book is The Revenge of Thomas Aikens. It's published by the Yale University Press.